Welcome to this special highlights program of two satellite CME symposia presented at the December American Society of Hematology meetings in San Diego. This is medical oncologist Dr. Neil Love. The theme of these conferences was what we call Beyond the Guidelines, and we presented the results of two surveys of 30 clinical investigators in each symposium topic area. To begin, I chatted with Dr. Maury Gertz, one of the faculty for our conference on multiple myeloma, who commented on the first major survey finding, which is the near universal utilization of triple therapy, generally lenalidomide, bortezomib, and dexamethasone, as upfront treatment of myeloma in the younger patient.
So there's no question, every trial that's been done, both for registration of an agent for relapse disease or for re-registration for newly diagnosed patients, usually have been comparisons of triplets versus doublets. So it'd be KRD versus RD. Or if you're looking at relapse disease, DARA-RD or VD versus RD-VD. And there hasn't been a single trial that has demonstrated equivalence between a doublet and a triplet. And so I think both for new patient induction and relapse therapy, if we only give a doublet, we're not serving our patients. Everything is showing, big hazard ratio reductions, 50, 60%. And they're showing not just relapse-free survival advantage, but overall survival advantage. So the idea of, well, I'm going to start with a doublet, and if I don't like what I see, I'm going to add in the third drug, it doesn't cut it based on the data, because these are U.S. studies where acquisition of the third agent is almost always available, yet it doesn't neutralize, the crossover doesn't neutralize the survival advantage. So I think that it's triplets, period, for basically all phases of the disease.
What about the use of carfilzomib? Obviously, there's a big randomized phase 3 trial looking at carfilzomib versus bortezomib, but several of the investigators are using it right now, including a couple of the faculty members, Drs. Langren and Orlowski. What are your thoughts about that?
I don't think it's justified. Obviously, other investigators have clinical trials where they're getting increased experience with the use of carfilzomib. Just because they're both proteasome inhibitors doesn't mean that they're equivalent in terms of efficacy. And there was just the recent publication of carfilzomib, melphalan-prednisone to bortezomib, melphalan-prednisone. That was a European trial, and there was no difference. And I think it's very important to recognize that thought leaders in the field created E1A11, which is KRD versus VRD for standard risk myeloma. And I think that we shouldn't be making the intellectual jump that K must be better than V because it's newer or less neurotoxic until we have the E1A11 results. And since, if you will, the control arm of E1A11 is VRD, I think that should remain the standard. There's also a convenience issue. If we're going to continue to use K twice a week, six times every 28 days, that's a big difference than subcutaneous dosing once a week.
We also asked this panel about the possibility of using weekly administration of carfilzomib. We didn't specify, but in general, I think that's going to be for relapse disease, particularly for patients who have difficulty traveling to clinic. I can imagine in the winter in Minnesota right now, that might be a little bit of an issue. But there were some data presented at the, I think it was the 2015 ASH meeting, looking at weekly carfilzomib. We asked this panel whether they would consider or would offer weekly administration of carfilzomib, particularly to someone who had difficulty getting to clinic. And actually, more than half of them would, including yourself. What are your thoughts about that?
So Berenson has published in manuscript form the results of their CHAMPION trial, which is the once-weekly carfilzomib administration schedule. And for people who aren't familiar, this is dose escalated. So the actual total dose of carfilzomib is almost the same. It's just given one day instead of 2 days. And I think what people want to know about is, well, when you double up the dose, did you increase the cardiac signal, the dyspnea, the hypertension? And the answer to that, based on a relatively small, less than 100 patients, phase 2 one arm, was that it did not increase it. And so it becomes rational. And I think it's desirable to get further data about the use of the escalated dose once weekly carfilzomib. And since there wasn't any obvious cardiac signal, I think it's very likely that bortezomib, which we swore had to be done 1-4-8-11, and now no one does that and uses it weekly, I think carfilzomib will follow suit.
Do you offer it to your patients routinely or only to people who have trouble getting to clinic?
There has to be a compelling reason to do it because the data is based on a relatively small cohort of patients where the data on the 1, 2, 8, 9, 15, 16 is close to 1,000 patients now. And I feel more comfortable with a more tried and true method.
You mentioned the, quote, cardiac signal with carfilzomib, and that's always been kind of a little bit confusing to me to try to sort out. Where do we stand right now in terms of that issue? You hear about some patients having dyspnea without apparent cardiac failure. Been kind of hard to really figure out for me exactly what's going on. What's your take about it?
Right. So Chari presented that at ASH 2016 and basically said, how serious is the cardiac signal from carfilzomib? And what he did is he took Medicare claims data and he looked at the incident rate for 1,000 patient years for hospitalization for cardiac events during carfilzomib-treated patients. And if you just look at any cardiac event, there were actually 90 hospitalizations per 1,000 patient years. I look at that and I think to myself, we might be overplaying the carfilzomib issue a little bit, and we just need to be a little more careful about not doing excessive hydration. And when he looked at heart failure, it was 40 hospitalizations per 1,000 patient years. And again, we're talking about an elderly population that's likely to have some element of coronary artery disease. So does carfilzomib have a cardiac signal? Yes. I think it's getting too much attention, frankly, and I wouldn't let it actually be a deciding factor for me in selecting a PI.
So do you have any particular concerns, or if you have a patient with a history of heart failure using carfilzomib?
So first of all, I think it's important that there's nothing that predicts. This isn't like giving doxorubicin where you get a pretreatment echocardiogram or MUGA scan to look at the ejection fraction, because those aren't predictive at all. And the same thing occurs with Holter monitoring or EKG. I just go ahead, I discuss the risks with the patient, I quote them under 5% for sure, and then I'll treat them. If there's a history, if they're on diuretics, if they have a significant history of hypertension, I'm very careful about the volume. And frequently what I'll do is reduce the pre-infusion volume by 50% and eliminate the post-infusion volume, just flush.
We also explored the issue of maintenance therapy in patients who've had transplant. We presented a 65-year-old patient without high-risk features, gets RVD, transplant, achieves a CR, and asked the panel what they would think about in terms of maintenance. And the vast majority would use lenalidomide by itself. Again, any thoughts on that? Has that become standard of care regardless of clinical response?
I think that's absolutely the right answer, and it is regardless. So that if a patient has a stringent CR or a PR, lenalidomide maintenance for every category improves relapse-free survival, and now with the meta-analysis that was performed by Nikhil Munshi, overall survival, when you take the three big trials, put them together. And so I think the national standard is len maintenance indefinitely to progression. If you look at how the thought leaders are designing new clinical trials, they're not doing any more clinical trials where the maintenance is 18 months or 24 or 36. It's maintenance to progression. And I think that for the time being, that is the correct answer.
And of course, when we ask these investigators, when you use lenalidomide maintenance, how long? 98% of them said exactly what you just said, which is until progression or toxicity. We also asked about the issue of a patient with adverse cytogenetics in terms of maintenance. So again, same case, but this time DEL17P, patient gets induction RVD, transplant, has a CR, but again, 17P. What we saw was a lot of use of lenalidomide plus a proteasome inhibitor, mostly bortezomib, but a number of people making the jump to exazomib. What are your thoughts about, again, maintenance therapy in this adverse cytogenetic situation?
I think it's the hardest question you've asked so far. because it's really difficult to know what to do with the 25% of high-risk patients when they come to maintenance. Again, because of the HOVON study that showed a dramatic benefit from using bortezomib every other week as the maintenance with a big improvement in the minus 17P, doing LEN plus every other week bortezomib becomes legitimate. But you know what? Oncologists are early adopters, and now they're asking about, well, maybe I should give lenalidomide with exazomib and just give that and only see them once every 28 days on maintenance. People are starting to ask me now about adding monthly daratumumab because it tends to be neutral in terms of cytogenetic abnormalities. I don't have answers for them, but you can see that these are all concepts worthy of exploring. But for the time being, every other week, bortezomib, lenalidomide 10 to 15 milligrams, 21 out of 28 days.
What do you feel about exazomib right now outside a trial setting in the maintenance setting? We asked the panel, and most of them would consider it in specific situations. I would guess maybe people had difficulty coming in the clinic, but how much data do you think it would take to actually incorporate exazomib into the maintenance setting? And how much of a benefit do you think it would be to be able to use oral therapy?
Well, for maintenance therapy, we're looking primarily to not compromise quality of life and keep it as convenient as possible. So when you're talking about maintenance therapy, oral, you know, is a really important consideration. But truly, the trial that has to be done is the complete induction, complete whatever you're doing, transplant, no transplant, consolidation, and then randomize to lenalidomide versus Len alone, because that's our national standard. And the endpoint for that has got to be overall survival, not relapse-free survival, because people who progress on Len can be salvaged with exazomib. We need to see survival data. But it's really quite rational. And exazomib, 4 milligrams, 1-8-15 every 4 weeks, is an awfully easy treatment. Very little GI toxicity, not much myelosuppression, a little cumulative anemia. It's a pretty easy agent to work with. And not nearly as neurotoxic as bortezomib. A little bit, but nothing, not even in the same logarithm.
I have heard people talk about GI issues with exazomib. Have you observed it? And what do patients tell you? And how do you manage that?
Yeah, it's pretty low grade, and they tend to develop tolerance to it. So you see more diarrhea than you do any nausea. The nausea is unpredictable, but it would be standard type of ondansetron or prochlorperazine antiemetic therapy for it. And the diarrhea, again, diphenoxylate would be reasonable treatment, a standard antidiarrheal. It doesn't really require much, and you don't really have to dose reduce.
You were talking about new ideas or directions in terms of maintenance therapy, mentioning daratumumab. I was curious, too, because we were talking in the meeting also about the possibility of looking at elotuzumab combined with lenalidomide. Obviously, that combination is being used in the relapse setting. It seems like it'd be a natural thing to be testing in the maintenance setting since we're already using lenalidomide. Any thoughts about that strategy?
It's reasonable. Again, the quality of life issue would argue that we're shooting to try and get to oral regimen, at least DARAs once a month in the maintenance. Elotuzumab being every 2 weeks would be a little less convenient, but obviously the biology underpinning the way it works in relapse disease would suggest it's a rational test of elo-len versus len.
I want to start to move into the issue of relapse refractory disease, where there's just so many options nowadays, it's kind of hard to sort out. So we presented a patient, younger patient, 65 years old, RVD, transplant, and then while receiving lenalidomide maintenance, has a limited asymptomatic biochemical relapse 18 months into treatment. And we saw a variety of answers, but mainly it was carfilzomib, either with Dex or carfilzomib Pom-Dex. Some people used elotuzumab plus RD. What are your thoughts about patients in this situation?
I think if I was going to give one message, my personal opinion, it would be if someone's progressing on maintenance lenalidomide, don't waste time doubling the dose. If they're progressing on 10, don't expect anything from going to 20 or 25, because what you'll end up with, in my opinion, is myelosuppression, and it's going to compromise your ability to salvage later. I like carfilzomib pomalidomide and my dexamethasone a lot, and I use it quite a bit. And I think the hard question that's going to come up for people in the community is, do I want to use Dara Pom Dex or carfilzomib Pom Dex as my triplet? Again, I don't think the data for a doublet, just carfilzomib Dex alone, is adequate. I just don't think doublet therapy for relapsed patients is the right way to approach it. You give the triplet and then you make modifications if there's toxicity. Carfilzomib Pom Dex is a favorite of mine.
What about the strategy? I know you mentioned that you didn't like the idea of bumping up the dose of lenalidomide, but what about doing that along with adding in elotuzumab in the situation?
It's unknown. Again, when you look at the elotuzumab-treated population, they were not lenalidomide resistant. These were people who were primarily not on len maintenance, who were randomized to elo-len versus len. And clearly, elo-len did better, but not in a len resistant population. And by definition, if you're progressing on maintenance, you have some degree of len resistance that I doubt is going to be improved by doubling the dose.
So we also presented a similar scenario, but again, in an older patient, a 78-year-old, this patient getting induction therapy with RVD light, followed by lenalidomide maintenance, but again, with a limited asymptomatic relapse. How do you think through the same situation, but in the older patient?
Well, I think, again, I'd be thinking hard about carfilzomib pomalidomide dex, but now you get into real logistical issues for the elderly to have to go through 6 injections, IV with pre and post hydration every 28 days. And for many, the logistics can be very, very difficult for that. And in those circumstances, then I start to look at, well, maybe there are better alternatives. Maybe in that situation, ixazomib would be a good choice for an older patient, or daratumumab pomdex would be reasonable, because eventually with the dara, you'll get to monthly treatment.
We were talking about daratumumab. Obviously, it's a huge entry into the field, and we're going to explore it as we talk about relapse refractory disease. But a couple issues that came up about daratumumab in the meeting, I'm curious if you want to comment on. One is the issue of infusion reactions. And we've heard, you know, issues of patients, particularly with their first dose, very prolonged therapy, very prolonged infusion necessary. Can you comment on the issue of infusion reaction? And the other issue that came out at the meeting that was discussed was the issue of blood banking and blood typing.
Well, start with the second one first. It's easier, but basically the IgG of daratumumab will adhere to the red cell surface. And as a consequence, you've got immunoglobulin on the red cell surface. That means they become Coombs positive. They don't hemolyze because the IgG has very low avidity to the red cell. And when the red cells go through the spleen, they get yanked off. But if a patient with myeloma has a hemoglobin of 6, has had daratumumab, and you want to transfuse them, they're a cross-match nightmare because you won't be able to find compatible cells because everything will react in the indirect Coombs because that antibody's on all the red cells and will cause agglutination in the microtiter plate. So as a consequence, you have two options. If you didn't do anything to prepare, then you end up giving them type-specific cells and hope that in all likelihood that in 3 weeks they won't have a delayed hemolytic transfusion reaction. The flip side is to just, once they start daratumumab, if you're thinking this patient's pretty anemic to begin with, is going to get more anemic, I'm going to need red cell genotyping. It's a call to the blood bank and saying, I think you need the red cell antigen type so that when you cross match, it's not just type specific, but you know they're DEL, their CDE, and their KEL, and their Duffy antigen makeup, so you can actually produce compatible red cells for transfusion. So that need to be aware of that Coombs positivity. And then the first question had to be with infusion reactions. And of course, oncologists have a lot of experience with first dose reactions to rituximab. These are a little bit more extreme, but we're pretty comfortable with expecting patients for the first antibody infusion to have fevers, to have rigors, to possibly have hypotension, to require slowing of the dose, splitting of the dose, use meperidine, use diphenhydramine, use acetaminophen, pause for IV saline infusion. We get that. And so it's a challenge, and a lot of private practice docs are actually hospitalizing patients for the first infusion, because usually after the first one, they get tachyphylaxis. You can knock it off in 3 to 4 hours. But one of the really exciting things that was presented at the meeting was subcutaneous daratumumab. They had formulated daratumumab with a special compound to enhance absorption, infused it. It wasn't a sub-Q injection. It was a sub-Q infusion, but it was only 15 to 30 minutes. And those patients had a much lower, and I think that that would be a big step towards wider spread adoption of the use of daratumumab if we could change the method of administration to subcutaneous.
Yeah, I thought that was really interesting. Can you talk more about the way it's given subcutaneously? It's like a sub-Q infusion, right?
That is correct. So it's put in a bag, and the volume's about 30 mLs, and then it is infused through just a subcutaneously placed small gauge needle, and that volume in the abdomen is, and they rotate sites, but that volume is not a problem. And the key here, we don't have efficacy data, but the pharmacokinetics and pharmacodynamics suggest that you achieve the same blood levels and same half-life with sub-Q as you do with parenterally administered. That would be a big deal.
Maybe you can talk a little bit about the data that we currently have on daratumumab and how you would compare the results that have been seen both with IMiDs as well as proteasome inhibitors, as well indirectly as other options in the relapse refractory setting, including carfilzomib, POM, DEX.
Right. So I think the two big trials, both published in the New England Journal, are the Castor and Pollux trial, which is daratumumab Lendex and daratumumab bortezomib Dex. And both of those were really powerful studies. And it goes beyond p-values. The p-values don't give the whole picture. It's the hazard ratio, the reduction in hazard function that was seen with daratumumab. It wasn't one of these 20%, it's 50 to 60% reduction in hazard function, very rapid, and appears to be independent, otherwise known as agnostic, to adverse cytogenetic abnormalities, that daratumumab doesn't seem to care whether you're a 414 or a minus 17P or normal fish. It is equally effective across all of those genetic subtypes. And so daratumumab, that's pretty exciting. We saw very similar results, though, with carfilzomib. Carfilzomib Lendex versus Lendex, we were seeing hazard reductions of 60%. We were seeing progression-free survival with that triplet of 22 months, which I'm used to seeing 1 year, 10 months would be the standard for progression-free survival for a myeloma therapy. So I think that Dara and carfilzomib, for that matter, are really hot for relapse disease, including aggressive relapse.
Where do you see Dara heading? You know, we've heard about the concept or thought of sort of the rituximab of myeloma. Is that the path that you think daratumumab is going to take? In other words, routinely used as part of upfront therapy? And again, just like rituximab, used extensively throughout the cycle of the disease.
I do. I think they're on the same trajectory. And so if you look back, if you're old enough to look back, how rituximab evolved its way until finally the two large national trials showed that R-CHOP was better than CHOP for lymphoma and R-CVP was better than CVP for low-grade lymphoma. I think that's exactly where myeloma is headed. And I think what we're going to be using is R-D plus a triplet for induction and D with a triplet for relapse. I think Dara is going to be widely, widely used.
Another relapse setting that we talked about is really beyond carfilzomib, POM-DEX. What you've been talking about is sort of your favorite and many of the other panelists' favorite for a first relapse. But then we asked about relapse beyond that. And in general, people use daratumumab more with an IMiD than with proteasome inhibitor. How do you decide whether to pair Dara with either an IMiD, proteasome inhibitor, or are there situations where you use it alone?
Right. I would try not to use it alone because then it's a doublet. but it really depends on what the prior therapy is. And in the scenarios we've been talking about, these are patients who've primarily been on long-term lenalidomide maintenance. And if you've been on lenalidomide when you progress, the idea of giving Dara with Len and Dex to me is just not appealing. Now, if you happen to be one of the few patients left that relapses not on an IMID, then I think it's completely legitimate to resume an IMID with Dara and Dex. But the patients that I'm seeing in my practice are progs on Len, so it's usually Dara combined with bortezomib.
I wanted to ask you about another issue that came out at the meeting that we were talking about, and the issue of the patient with renal failure. And there were a couple aspects to that that I was curious about. One, and I think we asked the audience this question, which is the issue of pomalidomide in a patient with renal failure. And actually, maybe you can talk a little bit. We found that the faculty in general would use pomalidomide in patients with renal failure, and many would use it at a lower dose. What is your approach to the situation?
I don't think you need to reduce the dose. If you look at the pharmacokinetics of pomalidomide, what you learned about lenalidomide does not apply. Pomalidomide has a distinct pharmacokinetic profile. It can be used full dose with renal failure. But while we're talking about it, daratumumab in the trials allowed people who had an EGFR greater than 20. Well, that's pretty generous. And so Dara is acceptable in terms of its ability to safely be given to patients with quite substantial renal failure. And hopefully we'll get to talk a little bit about this new dialyzer coil for patients who have CAS nephropathy.
That was actually my next question, because I know that was just presented at ASH, and I was amazed that they actually did a randomized study on that. Can you talk a little bit about what this filter is and what they just reported?
Right. So again, a dialysis filter for the non-nephrologist really is basically pore size. And so you've got basically usually cellulose acetate with pores that allow you to filter out all the small molecules that are toxic. And you know what they are. They're potassium, they're nitrogen, they're acids that are considered waste products for the body. But the problem is the pore size is too small to filter immunoglobulin light chains. And that's why dialysis has never been very effective at moving the light chains. Now, there's a filter that has a pore size that allows light chains, which in a monomer form, remember, are 25 kilodalton. In the dimeric form are 50 kilodalton. Those are pretty big molecules to filter through. And you can physically take the light chains out of the plasma using dialysis. Drawbacks. Number one, the dialysis session can run 15, 17 hours. There are many, many hospitals that do not have the facilities, the staffing, or the dialysis nurses to pair a nurse off for that long a period of time. It's a long dialysis. Secondly, that pore size also allows albumin to dialyze out. These people just lose tons and tons of albumin that has to be replaced on the back end. So it ends up being a substantial resource consumption to do it. But having said that, at 6 months, there were only half as many people who were dialysis dependent who got the filter for a period of 1 to 2 weeks. So that was pretty exciting news for a always difficult and challenging problem.
How often does that occur?
So 22% of patients will present with renal insufficiency. Probably half of those patients will respond to get the calcium under control, get saline diuresis started, give them their bisphosphonate, and begin a bortezomib-containing regimen right away. But between 5 and 10% don't get better. And some of them will have persistent renal insufficiency, which will dog them for the rest of their course because it complicates administration of every therapy they receive from that point on. And then, of course, for the very unfortunate few, 2-3%, they're on a life of dialysis. Their survival is not as good as other myeloma patients. They're not as good as other patients who are dialyzing because of chronic kidney disease. And every single patient that you keep off dialysis is not just a quality of life issue, but we're talking about 150 dialysis sessions a year. It's a big deal for our patients.
I wanted to ask you about some new directions in treatment of myeloma that we got into, or we even asked people about. in terms of even the possibility of, you know, considering using outside a trial setting, or say trying to strongly find a way to get a patient into a trial. And the first that just kind of came on my radar recently, because we've been talking about the agent venetoclax, of course, in CLL now for quite a while, but it looks like it has activity in a specific subset of myeloma also. Can you talk about what venetoclax is and what we know about it in myeloma?
Right. So venetoclax inhibits B-cell leukemia 2, better known as BCL2, and it's well recognized to have a high level of activity in patients with CLL, although it's unlikely it's going to make it the first-line therapy. We'll see. But there's no question that in patients who carry an 11-14 translocation, many of whom were triple and quad refractory, there was a 40% objective response rate to venetoclax. And for those who don't use it a lot, it's basically a pill taken three times a week. Toxicity is very, very modest with venetoclax. And since it's available in CLL, in my practice, if I had an 11-14 patient and I could get it as an off-label for a myeloma patient, I'd work hard to do so. I was very impressed with the data.
Yeah, I've heard a bunch of people say that. One of the issues in CLL, though, is tumor lysis syndrome, and there are a lot of stipulations. There's actually a table in the package insert about how to prevent or try to prevent TLS. What do we know about TLS in patients getting venetoclax with myeloma?
Well, you know, before we even get to venetoclax, let's just restate that tumor lysis syndrome has been recognized for 50 years in ALL, Burkitt's lymphoma, CLL, but seeing it in myeloma has been very, very rare. I mean, we went 35 years and I didn't see any tumor lysis syndrome until carfilzomib came along. And then all of a sudden, carfilzomib, we had tumor lysis, which of course for refractory myeloma may be a good problem to have. I wouldn't automatically just take the CLL data and automatically assume that every patient has to be on allopurinol and bicarbonate saline infusions, and we have to be prepared to give them respiracase to prevent tumor lysis syndrome, because most of the myeloma populations are so heterogeneous, you'll knock off 30-40%, but getting a tumor lysis, I'd like to wait for reports to occur before we have to routinely adopt prophylactic therapy against tumor lysis, because when you start talking that way, you're really implying people have to be hospitalized for the first couple days to get an oral drug. And I'd like to see harder data before we make that jump.
Yeah, and of course, actually, the package insert, the table that, you know, not everybody is recommended to come into the hospital, it's based in CLL on the white count and the size of the nodes, two things that obviously are not relevant in myeloma. So I guess to be continued. I want to ask you about another therapy that's being looked at in myeloma that I'm starting to hear a lot about and curious what your perception is and whether or not you consider even outside a trial setting, and that's anti-PD-1 antibodies, particularly combined with IMiDs.
Right. So Mari V. Mateos for the Spanish Myeloma Study Group showed some impressive data combining pembrolizumab as the PD-1 antibody with lenalidomide. And again, this was single-arm data, but really impressive progression-free survivals for what I think is a relatively non-toxic agent. But because it was combined, unlike venetoclax, where it was used all by itself without steroids, where the activity was very, very clear, when you combine pembrolizumab with len, which is so incredibly active in a single arm, it's hard to know how hard you want to work to try and get pembrolizumab in combination. I think it's a lot like elotuzumab, where until the phase 3 trial was completed, we didn't realize how much activity it had when it was combined with lenalidomide. I think they are tracking similar approval pathways.
So I take it then that you would necessarily be interested in using a checkpoint inhibitor outside a trial setting in myeloma.
Correct. I need more data.
So another topic we got into at the meeting was Waldenstrom macroglobulinemia. We asked about upfront therapy in a patient with normal renal function who required treatment, and we saw people being split between bendamustine plus or minus rituximab versus rituximab bortezomib plus or minus dexamethasone. Can you talk a little bit about your approach to patients up front?
Right. So no criticism for either one. I tend to like bendamustine because, other than myelosuppression, it's well tolerated. And this is a very elderly population that we're talking about. If anything, I think the big mistake with bendamustine is using 90 per meter squared for 2 days every 28. They're old. They have marrow compromise. I'll give 90 per meter squared day one only. And after two cycles, see how much myelosuppression there is before I move ahead. The other piece with Waldenstrom's is these patients with IgM have a pretty high prevalence of latent peripheral neuropathy. And in the published trials of rituximab, bortezomib, dex, the neurotoxicity was double what it was in multiple myeloma. And I don't like this neurotoxicity issue. And that leans me towards bendamustine. But if I see a patient referred to me for an opinion and they're on bortezomib, rituximab, dex, I do not change that regimen. That's a legitimate choice.
Has any work been done with exazimib in Waldenstrom's?
So there are trials, there are two trials actually, both with exazimib as well as with aprozomib for the treatment of Waldenstrom's, both. And, you know, they're active. But one of the problems with a rare disease like Waldenstrom's, which is only a tenth as common as myeloma, is we don't have phase three data that will allow us to make decisions. And if you have to come once a month for exazimib or once a month for bendamustine, I don't know that there's much difference between those two regimens. And it's, I think, not very likely that they'll be in such an orphan disease compared head-to-head.
So we also asked the panel about the issue of a patient who had a IgM level that was elevated. We said 3,600, but without symptoms of hyperviscosity. And we found that at that level, we started to see investigators, about a third, who would change what they would do, mainly hold the rituximab and give the chemotherapy. How do you approach patients who have elevated IgM levels as well as those with hyperviscosity?
Right. So the level is important. I mean, even at 3,600, if you had a flare of 50%, that gets you to 5,400. That's not likely to cause hyperviscosity either. So where you're starting from, it's a big difference if you're starting at 3,600 or at 7,000, because a 7,000 patient would be at risk of a flare. And if they've been indolent, it's legitimate to withhold a rituximab. At most lower levels, I don't get too excited about it. I think that hyperviscosity is actually overplayed in terms of what I'm used to seeing. And I think one of the issues with hyperviscosity is that the classic findings of nose bleeding and gum bleeding and retinal bleeding, now all of a sudden I'm seeing patients in my practice referred on plasma exchange for headaches. I mean, they have headaches, but they have a hemoglobin of 8, or they're confused a little bit, or they're forgetful. And I think those are such soft findings. I think it's really important to measure the viscosity. A lot of labs can't do it. It's worth the mail-in to really know whether you're dealing with an unimportant viscosity of 3 or 3.5, or something that's a real big deal, 5 to 6.
We also asked the panel about the issue of second-line therapy of Waldenstrom's, and here we start to see a lot of use of ibrutinib. We presented a case of a patient who got bendamustine rituximab up front and found that most investigators would then go to ibrutinib. We asked about use of first-line therapy with ibrutinib, and in general, people don't do it, although a few people did, but would consider it in certain situations. What are your thoughts about ibrutinib and Waldenstrom's?
So I agree with both your statements. I think that as second-line therapy, ibrutinib has been studied and shows an awfully good response rate. It's oral. Now, there are issues, of course. Atrial fibrillation in the Waldenstrom's population is 11%. And this business with the soft tissue bleeding, that type of exotica and suppression of counts is real. But by and large, most patients tolerate it quite well. So a second-line therapy, I agree. For first-line therapy, I don't think it's ready for prime time yet, but it's coming, because there are trials that are ongoing with the use of ibrutinib as first-line therapy for Waldenstrom's macroglobulinemia, and I think that if those trials show higher rates than what we're expecting to see with bortezomib or bendamustine, it has the potential to become a first-line agent.